This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Independent's Coronavirus Podcast. I'm David Marley, Deputy Editor at The Independent. This podcast is about getting behind the headlines, examining the issues that are affecting our lives as we try to navigate our way through these extraordinary times. It also gives us a chance to find out more about the wider impact of the virus and how the rest of the world is coping and responding. Today, I'm joined by The Independent's policy correspondent, John Stone. Before he returned to London in March, John spent almost 3 years in Brussels covering Brexit. It seems a lifetime ago that the news was dominated by talk of our relationship with the EU and on what terms we would leave. Countless stories on the withdrawal agreement, the backstop, and record government defeats in the Commons. In the wake of coronavirus, our obsession with Brexit has finally started to go away, although discussions about our future relationship with the bloc continue. But how is the EU coping with this crisis? France, Italy, and Spain have all been very badly affected, but the impact has been far from consistent, and different countries have responded in different ways, with some suggesting that the longer-term impact of the virus could be to undermine the whole European project. So, John, welcome to the podcast. I'm delighted you found the time to be with us today. Can you start by giving us an overview of how the European has responded to this crisis?
Hi, David. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me on. The first thing to remember is that public health, that's not traditionally been a responsibility of the European Commission, of the European Union. So it's something that member states have managed on their own. And we've seen countries do it in different ways. Although most have now fallen in with similar types of things like lockdowns and restrictions on freedom of movements, although there are exceptions. But over the course of the pandemic, the European Commission, basically what we would call Brussels, when we're writing about the EU, has got involved, although it did take some time for that to happen. You may have seen criticism in the media at a lack of help for Italy when the outbreak was focused on Italy. Now, you could obviously ask whether that criticism is reasonable or not, because it's not technically the EU's responsibility to do anything on this. But they are now, so it has now ground into gear, and there are a number of areas in which it's responding. So the EU initially started to get involved actually for a very specific reason, which if there's one thing that Brussels cares about, it's to safeguard the European project. So basically the crisis actually in its initial stages looked like it was going to kind of damage the European project. So you had countries throwing up border controls between each other, and that undermines free movement, quite a big cornerstone of the EU. You had some countries even putting export bans on protective equipment. So, for instance, Germany actually even started to impose export bans on protective equipment, which Germany makes a lot of the protective equipment in Europe, and other countries relied on its deliveries. So Brussels looked at this and said, well, these actions are undermining the single market. Countries are going their own way. What can we do about this? And although there was a lot of rhetoric from, say, Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, she was saying, oh, the pandemic doesn't respect borders, which is, you know, true, very, very true. I think the actual impetus for the Commission getting involved was actually the perceived threat to European unity rather than, you know, a particular sense of duty that it was their job to get involved in the pandemic, because it is a competence of member states.
Have they been able to do that then? Have they been able to impose some kind of more unified approach, or are states still kind of going their own way and just looking to protect, understandably protect their own populations?
So there's certainly, they've certainly done things and announced initiatives, whether it's cosmetic or whether member states are actually falling into line is difficult to say, and it probably varies on a case-by-case basis. So the first thing the Commission did when countries started throwing up borders with each other was they actually announced a sort of a general closure of the European Union's external borders for non-essential travel. And the hope there was that once you close the borders externally, that will allow countries to reopen their borders within the bloc with each other. That hasn't really happened, but now that the virus is everywhere, it doesn't, and no one's really traveling, it doesn't really matter. One problem that was being created by countries closing borders with each other was you actually started to have disruption in freight flows. So there was actually a 37-mile tailback on the border between Germany and Poland, which is exactly the sort of thing that sets red lights flashing in Brussels. And they managed to solve that by intervening and introducing something called, they call them green lanes, basically priority border crossings for trucks. And that actually did solve that problem. So you could argue in that respect it was successful, although there are still restrictions on movement between EU countries, but then people aren't really trying to move between EU countries at the moment unless they're delivering freight very much. So the other approach that the Commission took is that they also kind of tried to give member states something positive to show how the European project could help them and that they would tackle the virus and that do things that they couldn't do by themselves. So the first thing that they've did is they've had regular meetings of EU ministers and even EU leaders by video conference. And there've been about half a dozen of the leaders now. And actually the Home Affairs and Health Ministers actually meet several times a week via video conference. It's quite a significant thing. And it is interesting to think actually that if the UK was in the European Union, this would be a regular news event that we would be covering, because you know you'd have Matt Hancock going on calls with the other 27 ministers, you'd have Boris Johnson chatting with Angela Merkel and things like that in quite a high profile way. But that's obviously not happening.
Has it been a kind of Germany France led effort in those meetings? Obviously Germany's been pretty heavily and widely praised for kind of the way that it's tackled the crisis.
They've actually been mostly split, France and Germany, on a lot of issues. One of the other things that the European Commission has done is they're trying to organise what they call a rescue package, like a stimulus. Basically, this is to deal with the economic fallout of the pandemic. So it's not something to fight the pandemic, but essentially it's how do we stop the European economy grinding to a halt when this is all over. And France and Germany have actually more or less, although it's maybe a bit of a simplification, but they've more or less gone on different sides of that. So Germany is much more wary of spending money and doesn't want to be rushed into any European integration that it didn't really, you know, it doesn't really want to cede more power to the Commission. Whereas Macron in France is significantly more, he's more enthusiastic about that, and he's more sympathetic to countries like Spain and Italy that are saying, well, you need to send us some cash, because what's European solidarity if it's not to help us out in a crisis? That stimulus package is actually probably the biggest thing the European Union is doing now. It's dominated debate on the continent at a European level, although most countries are also looking inwards in the same way as the UK to their national health authorities. There was some progress made on that stimulus package last week, actually. It was a big European Council meeting, again, video conferenced. It's basically the equivalent of a summit, but done via video conference for obvious reasons, social distancing. Basically, some countries wanted a big redistribution. Some countries wanted a more modest programme of loans. You can probably guess that richer countries generally wanted to pay less and poorer countries generally wanted to pay more. It's sometimes portrayed as a north and south division, the rich north with the poorer south. Again, that's quite vague, but there's also kind of a second layer to it. So as I said, Macron wants more integration, but Germany is less in favour of it.
Is there a sense that, I mean, obviously we were the prime, the kind of the number one malcontent in the EU when we were there. If we've now left, is there a sense that different countries are using the crisis to push their own agenda on this? We know that when we were there, we were kind of obviously causing a lot of problems for the EU, didn't want further integration. We know that Macron does. Are different countries using this to kind of push their own wider European agendas?
Yes, I think that's undoubtedly true, particularly on Macron. I mean, it's a cliche that, oh, change comes in crises or crises are opportunity. And I think, but it's a cliche that everybody is aware of, and whether or not it's actually a good way of making European policy, it is actually the way that European policy has been made. The big changes to European structure in the past have tended to happen in times of crisis. It's a time you can bounce people out of positions, which long-held positions that they've been stubbornly entrenched in. And I think that's, particularly people who want more integration, that's been something that they have... they've seized upon. But you mentioned the UK not being the intransigent one. It's actually interesting because there was, I remember when the UK was leaving, there was actually there was an interesting idea going around. And people would say, well, the UK is often seen as, the UK is a sort of a useful excuse for a lot of countries who don't actually want to do things, but they would just say, they would just blame the UK because they knew that they could rely on Britain to basically block any change. And now a lot of those countries are actually having to come out and do their own dirty work. So the Netherlands is sometimes described as the new Britain because they are the guys who don't want to do anything, basically. The Netherlands has basically led the charge in opposing... giving the European Commission much more sweeping powers to borrow money on the currency markets in order to respond to this crisis, which was a key demand of the southern states like Spain and which was broadly endorsed by Macron. The Netherlands side actually essentially won that battle, and there aren't really going to be any extensions of powers, but to give more borrowing power to the Commission, although it's not going to be able to borrow money by itself without member states, but the compromise that was broadly reached last week in the meeting was that it's going to be able to, with the backing of member states in the way that it did before, get significantly more money on the capital markets, but in the same way as it was doing before. So there's not really a qualitative change in the way it's doing things. It's more of a, it's just massively ramping up the amount of what they call own resources it has. To respond to crisis like this. It's I mean, that's a tentative compromise. It was reached last week, and it won't be fully solved for a while, but I mean, the crisis will be going for a while, so they've got a while. It's also kind of interlinked with the EU budget negotiations, which is a sort of, every 7 years they negotiate a new 7-year budget, and it takes like probably about 2 years to do it. It's a very wrangling process. So it makes it even more complicated, and everybody's sort of fighting for their own position within that context. Aside from the stimulus package, there are actually a couple of other things that the Commission's done. So one thing is also focused on the end of the crisis. They want member states to relax their social distancing measures, their lockdowns, in a synchronised way, and they've published an action plan. I think it's fair to say that this has basically been ignored by most member states.
That's already not working, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's doing it at different speeds and different paces, and they don't really have any powers to force people to do it. The justification for putting it out initially was, well, all these measures were brought in a haphazard way, and that caused border controls to come up. So if we don't want border controls to be imposed again at the end of the crisis, well, we all need to do this in a synchronized way. But the problem is, because all these countries have gone into the crisis at different points, they've also gone, I mean, they'll also be going out of the crisis at different points because they've dealt it in different ways. I mean, in a way, I can see why the Commission is sensitive about this, because they're sensitive about the idea of European unity. But it is worth considering. I mean, if you look at a unitary state like Italy has imposed different restrictions and even travel restrictions between its own provinces. And I don't think anybody's talked, well, maybe they are, but I don't think anybody seriously thinks that Italy is going to fall apart in the next, maybe I'll eat my words on that, when you never know what's going to happen these days. But and the Northern League was obviously in government recently. But I mean, it is perhaps an oversensitivity. I mean, it might be that travel restrictions between member states during a pandemic or doing things at different times is reasonable because countries are doing that inside. So if the EU is worried about not being seen as a policy, then it can, you know, maybe point out some, well, you can be a policy and do this stuff. It doesn't make you any less of a intergovernmental organization just because you have different policies in different parts of your area, so to speak.
Sure. One of the kind of things which has hit home in the UK is this kind of EU procurement scheme to get protective equipment, masks or ventilators or other kind of healthcare equipment, which very confusingly, we seem to be have invited to have joined or not, or there was an email that we did see or didn't see. There was all kinds of excuses and kind of changing stories about why we had or hadn't joined that scheme. What's the situation with that? Could we have? Should we have? Would it have alleviated some of the pressures we currently see?
Yes. Yeah, so that procurement scheme was probably the other big thing that the European Union has done for the crisis, and it's arguably, it has the potential to be a success, actually. It's probably too early to tell, but it's probably one of the most concrete measures in tackling the crisis they've done. So the idea was to use the power of the single market, which, if you include Britain, has over 500 million people. It's basically the world's biggest economy, to get priority for protective equipment and ventilators, of which there's a global shortage because all countries are, you know, trying to buy up what they can. So the idea behind it is, well, you've got 500 million people, guaranteed orders, 27 or 28 governments making orders for this stuff. Suppliers will be very keen to prioritise these huge orders because they're very profitable. And it's actually, I mean, they have managed to place significant orders. That's a triumph in itself. And they say that they should be getting more than they need, although stuff hasn't physically yet been delivered, which critics of the scheme, particularly in the UK, do point out. Although it's not clear that that's necessarily a problem, because the idea was to get more equipment arriving basically as you run out of stuff. The UK is doing similar stuff. It's trying to secure, the UK is not part of the scheme, it's independently trying to secure supplies of protective equipment, and that's ongoing. A lot of that won't have been delivered. This is stuff that should be arriving within the next few weeks if it goes to plan. But the question of whether Britain is joining it or not is actually quite an interesting one. So the UK, as listeners may or may not know, is still in the transition period for Brexit. So it can participate in most union programmes. It's essentially treated as a member state for economic purposes, but has no say at the political level. So that includes the procurement scheme, which the Commission did say in March the UK could join if it wanted to. That was when the scheme was launched, in mid-March, broadly. There have been discussions about it before. And the UK basically decided not to participate. And since then, the government has basically kind of oscillated between two public lines as to why it didn't take part in the scheme. On the one, you've had ministers like Therese Coffey said, well, it's pointless. There's no point. Like, we can do all this alone. We don't need the help of the single market to do it. And then you've also had other ministers and Downing Street actually saying, well, there was this screw up. We missed taking part in the scheme. There was an email that we didn't see, something to that effect. The latter of those excuses, the one that Downing Street's pushing, that they missed the email, or they somehow weren't notified to take part in the scheme, sounds, to be honest, pretty, it's insubstantial. I mean, there are minutes of UK officials being in meetings where the scheme was discussed. It was, I mean, as a journalist writing stories about this, we saw that the UK was invited to take part and wrote stories about politicians asking Downing Street to take part in the scheme. And it would be very, unless the government is like grossly incompetent, it would be very, very difficult for them to have actually missed that they were allowed to do this. I mean, I would say impossible, and I would say that they didn't miss it. So, I mean, if you lay the timeline of events out, it all looks very strange. So, for instance, the deadline for placing orders under the scheme, Downing Street said, oh, we missed the deadline to place orders. We can't order anymore, but we'll do it in the future. Well, the deadline was actually well after. It was like several weeks after Downing Street said that they had, you know, oh, we missed the email, we couldn't do it. So it doesn't really stack up in that regard. Whether the scheme would have been useful or not, well, I mean, I'm afraid we don't have the information to tell whether what that's like, but we do know that Matt Hancock, the health secretary, has been getting up on stage and over the last couple of months and saying, oh, we're working night and day to try and secure new supply lines for protective equipment.
Could have been, at the very least, could have been a good supply line.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems to be a supply line for protective equipment. It, as I say, it doesn't seem to have actually, the things ordered under the scheme haven't been physically delivered yet, but that's because things take time to make and produce. And it does seem that it would have been useful. I mean, we've asked the government, like, is there a reason why? And they haven't really given a particularly good explanation as to why it's not useful, and continue to say that they're searching for PPE, so for protective equipment. So it's quite a mysterious one, that one. It's a bit of a subplot, but I think, it does have the makings of potential scandal, maybe when the dust settles and people can pay a bit more attention to it.
Now, as you mentioned there, we are still in the transition period, so we've officially left the EU, no longer members. Brexit has happened, but we're in this transition period, working out what the trading relationship is going to be, supposedly from the 1st of January next year. Now, there's been lots of questions raised about whether we can reach that deal whilst both us and the EU are dealing with a much more important issue at the moment. So what do you think the chances are? The government is standing firm, saying they're going to leave anyway, that they will strike a deal, stick to their timetable. Can Brexit talks and the kind of future relationship talks really reach any kind of effective conclusion while this is all happening around it?
It's very difficult to know. I mean, I suppose the whole thing has been unpredictable since the start. I mean, there are certainly difficulties that have been caused by this. I mean, that's an understatement. But the specific ones with the talk, just to recap for anyone who hasn't been following that closely, they had a round of talks early in the year, the first round of trade talks, and, you know, they took some precautions. They put hand sanitizer on desks and things like that, but it wasn't being taken too seriously. And then the pandemic swept in quite quickly, and, you know, international travel was cancelled. The UK was very keen to continue talks and do them via video conferencing, but the Commission, the European side, was actually quite reticent to do that. And the justification that officials were giving for that was that it's very well to video conference between two sides, but you still, on each side, have to get several people into a room together to be on the conference. That was what they argued anyway. Now they've started doing the talks via video conference. They did the first round of video conference talks last week. As to whether the talks will actually make progress in time, that's difficult to say. There are the same stumbling blocks that you had before the break, before they resumed video conferencing. We were told that there's been no progress on those stumbling blocks, essentially. Michel Barnier sounded pessimistic. I mean, he always sounds pessimistic, usually, but... nobody really disputed what he was saying. I think one of the biggest issues with this is that actually the way that a lot of diplomacy and negotiations work, yes, you have your officials, you have about 225, I think is the number, officials involved in talks. Yes, they sit at tables, they argue about the technical stuff, they try and come to conclusions. But the way that these things are really unblocked is in the corridors outside, like side negotiations, kind of off the record, where you can show a bit more flexibility. And those simply don't happen when video conferencing is happening. Actually, Michel Barnier said this in public. It was quite a candid moment. He said it was very, very difficult to see how that kind of diplomacy could be conducted. Now, I know both sides are actually aware of that, so it's possible that they're going to find some solution to it. Maybe they'll go for, you know, Zoom drinks afterwards or something like that. But it's... But it certainly doesn't bear well, especially when we've had a couple of months out of an already extremely ambitious schedule, and both sides don't seem like they really want to budge on this or really have the political bandwidth to think about budging, because everyone's really talking about the pandemic, and that's what governments are concerned with.
Do you think there's resentment building in Brussels that when they're trying to deal with this unprecedented crisis, they've also got the UK on the sidelines still demanding their attention?
I don't think there'll be necessarily resentment as that the UK is leaving and demanding attention, but I think if there isn't a change in government position by June to extend, I think things could get a little bit fiery because they, yeah, basically for the reasons you've spelled out, it seems, you know, the Commission's argument is, well, Boris Johnson actually negotiated this withdrawal agreement that we had with him, and the withdrawal agreement was, we went through it line by line with him, and it included an option to extend. So it's very strange for Boris Johnson to now be saying, well, we've included this option to extend, but we don't want to use it under any circumstances, and we've legislated it out of existence in our domestic law. That would be their argument. Boris Johnson would say, well, I was elected on a manifesto of not extending the transition period. Perhaps you might argue that, well, they couldn't have foreseen that there was a global pandemic that made it impossible to conduct meaningful negotiations for several months, and possibly longer, we don't know. But yeah, both sides will come to that. In terms of what the UK side are saying, they're absolutely emphatic. They won't be extending. That's what they say. But it is worth remembering that the UK government has pretty much since 2016, since the referendum, said at every available opportunity that it would not extend anything. It would never delay anything. And then equally at every available opportunity, so far it has delayed.
How many extensions were there last year? I've lost count, or I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long, long list. There's a long list. It depends what you, it depends how you count, but I mean, you can say at least three, but there's an argument for saying more. Yeah, so I mean, that's really the difficulty. There's also kind of a dynamic in the UK government, which is that although the withdrawal agreement that Boris Johnson got was more or less a compromise, a lot of senior Tories do actually believe their own PR, which is that it was a deal that they got everything and they got it by brinkmanship, which is how they sold it to Brexiteer voters. Mm. But in terms of the actual reality of what happened, I think that's a misreading of the situation. But if they do genuinely believe their own PR and try and do brinkmanship on this, I mean, then a no deal is very likely. The UK has to agree to extend or not by in June. The decision has to be made. There'll be a sort of a summit. It will probably be a video conference at this rate. I hope it's a summit because I'd love to go back to Brussels and cover it, but I suspect we probably won't be there by then. And they'll take stock. So that'll be the moment when we know whether that's happening or not for sure. Although, to be honest, we probably won't really, really know until December, because absolutely every deadline in this story gets pushed to the absolute maximum. So, yeah, we've got a long, long road ahead of us on Brexit.
What you're saying is that even though I thought we'd stopped reporting about Brexit in only June, and in just a couple of months' time, it's going to be back front and centre in the agenda about whether we do or don't go for an extension.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's actually up to us, it's up to other news organisations, and it's up to readers and politicians how much attention people actually pay to this. Because, yeah, it's an important crunch moment. There are several deadlines coming up. After June, there needs to be a deal on fisheries by July. That's not a hard deadline, but it's one that both sides have committed to. And then there's more deadlines again in December. So there are Brexit deadlines scattered throughout all this year. But what could happen is that with Brexit being a much lower priority, it doesn't dominate the headlines in the same way because of the pandemic. The political dynamics change, but we don't know which way they'll change. They could change in the sense that, well, people aren't paying attention to this, you can get away with more. So let's, extend the transition period. People won't be as angry. I mean, we've seen poll after poll show that actually quite a significant majority of people wouldn't really mind the transition period being extended, because they can see this is a reasonable, this isn't something that they expected to happen. Once in a century pandemic. But, The alternative school of thought is, well, perhaps, and this is, I think some diplomats do think that this is what may happen, is that, yes, so there's less scrutiny on the process, but there's also less scrutiny on the outcome. So those elements within the Conservative Party, within Downing Street, who would be quite happy with a no deal, but don't want to take the economic damage, or maybe even quite like the idea of a no deal, not saying that it's not government policy, but there are some in the Conservative Party who have been arguing for a no deal all along. That's not a secret. They might say, well, yes, we can get away with a no deal. And also, you know, yeah, there'll be economic damage, but it'll get tied up in the even greater economic damage, or equally strong economic damage, or actually, who knows, because it's all going to be the same economic damage of the pandemic, and it's very difficult to separate those two out. And while that's an interesting point in terms of that specific decision, it's actually also just an interesting to look at it as an overview. We'll actually never know how much damage Brexit does, no matter what happens, because we just had like the most single damaging economic event of the century happen like literally 3 months after it, or like 1 month after it. I mean, it was literally happening while it happened. It's impossible to tell. So those pub arguments are going to be going for quite a long time, I imagine. I don't think we're going to be able to settle that one for anybody who is looking for a satisfying ending to that.
It's the perfect cover. All right. Well, John, that's fascinating. Thank you very much for talking us through that stuff. Look forward to talking to you again when Brexit does come back on the agenda, inevitably. And thank you to everyone for listening. If you're a new listener, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen. If you have suggestions for things you'd like us to discuss, do get in touch on email at thecoronaviruspodcast@independent.co.uk, or you can use the hashtag IndieCoronavirusPodcast, INDY, IndieCoronavirusPodcast, and we'll see your post. You can read all about the unfolding pandemic on our website, independent.co.uk, and in our downloadable daily edition. There's also an email newsletter you can sign up to with the latest news delivered daily to your inbox. Thank you so much again for listening, and please do join us again next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.